welcome you all to the last scheduled argument in January, and a special welcome to students from Germantown High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. Students across the state in private schools, public schools, and homeschool, students are invited to come and participate with us in an oral argument. They're given materials about the case that they would be hearing, and then they have the opportunity to meet with a justice assigned for that day to meet with students to discuss the procedures that the court uses for taking a case, hearing a case, deciding a case, and then distributing its opinion. And everyone is welcome to come to the session with the students and the justice. We ordinarily have two oral arguments in the morning, and the discussion with the justices is at noon after the second oral argument. Today we have one oral argument. And are the students available right after the oral argument to meet with the justice? That's the way we'll do it, if that's all right with you.
Okay.
Thank you. We've met you. Now let us introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. She is the justice who will meet with you immediately after this case hearing is concluded. On my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. On Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. On Justice Crooks's left is Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, before I call the case, does anyone want a summary of the case that we are about to hear? The marshal will give it to you. If you raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. All right. Called the case 2013 AP 1303, Acuity versus Chartis Specialty Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Acuity is Michael J. Cohn, Attorney Cohn. Arguing on behalf of Chartis Specialty Insurance Company is Attorney Mark W. Ratton. And Mr. Cohn will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel? You may proceed.
Please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Cohen, and along with my colleague, Joseph Sarmiento, we have the honor and privilege of representing the appellant, Acuity Mutual Insurance Company, in this case. This case has three what I believe to be important features which differentiates this case from other cases that have been decided by this court and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals relating to pollution cases in general. First, unlike prior decisions of this court interpreting pollution exclusions, what is at issue here is a grant of coverage under Chartis' CPL policy for property damage, bodily injury, and environmental damage caused by pollution conditions, not a pollution exclusion. And that's significant for several reasons. First, it's well settled that when there is an ambiguity in the language of a coverage grant, the language is construed broadly in favor of coverage. Secondly, this court has repeatedly noted in Donaldson and other cases, including the recent decisions by this court,
they're referring to Priestler and Wilson.
And Wilson Mutual. Mm-hmm. In relation to the interpretation of a pollution exclusion, that, quote, the reach of a pollution exclusion must be circumscribed by reasonableness, lest the contractual promise of coverage be reduced to a dead letter. And that language comes from the Seventh Circuit decision in Pipefitters, initially articulated by the court in Donaldson, then reiterated just recently in Wilson Mutual and Falk. This concern resulted in this court recognizing certain limiting principles in its decisions on the pollution exclusion, which it reiterated again most recently in the Priestler decision. However, such limiting principles are not necessary when addressing a grant of coverage as opposed to an exclusion, because there's no concern that the broad interpretation of the terms of a grant of coverage could result in illusory coverage, which was really the issue there.
Mr. Cohen, I'm not quite sure. I guess I do understand why you're arguing the distinction between a grant and an exclusion. But in Wilson Mutual, a case in which our chambers has an interest, pollution is defined as, one way to define pollution is, one, a substance largely undesirable and not universally present in the context, in this case, of a construction site, and two, a reasonable insured would consider natural gas to be a pollutant. Why wouldn't you be arguing that from Wilson?
Oh, we certainly are, Your Honor, and we believe that those principles are met here, and I'll explain why.
Do we know what actually caused, I don't think anyone disputes it but for the leak of the natural gas that the explosion wouldn't have occurred. Do we know what actually ignited it, and should we be concerned about that?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the grant of coverage in the Chartist CPL policy is very broad. The underlying complaints don't specifically identify the ignition source, if you will, which what ignited the gas, but I think the court can recognize it's well established that when large concentrations of natural gas are released into the environment, as was alleged here, any sort of spark could cause an ignition, which, in fact, is alleged here and caused significant property damage and bodily injury to the extent large enough of an explosion to blow up an entire church and cause significant damage to two residences. The point I'm trying to make is that the limiting principle.
Mr. Cohen, you started out saying you have three features that were different. One is that this is, in Chartis, is coverage, not exclusion. What are the other two before you deal with them in detail?
Sure. Second, Your Honor, unlike prior cases addressing the pollution exclusion under Wisconsin law, particularly Donaldson and the Court of Appeals decision in Langone, this case features a coverage grant that includes already built into it a substance that is otherwise universally present may still be a contaminant, provided the conditions that led to the loss are not naturally present in the environment in the amounts and concentrations discovered.
That's exactly in the policy.
That's in the Chartis definition of pollution conditions, which is different than the other cases. In fact, reflects one of the limiting principles. Here it's actually added into the grant of coverage. And it's an important distinction in terms of differentiating from this case, cases such as Donaldson and Langone, which address accumulations of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide within the confines of a building or an apartment, as well as the other non-Wisconsin cases that Chartis realizes that do not involve this additional language that Chartis itself added into its broad grant of coverage. And in Donaldson and Langone, the courts determined that carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide respectively, were universally present and generally harmless in all but the most unusual circumstances.
Counsel?
Here.
Number three
is what?
This case arises in the context of the duty to defend. And that's significant because the test is whether coverage was fairly debatable. And that includes fairly debatable legal issues as well.
No, but you're asking, if I read your brief right, and I agree that it's a duty to defend case two, you're asking for indemnification. That is, to share the amount you paid out, which was roughly $1.5 million.
That is correct.
And you got a judgment from the circuit court against Chartis for half of the indemnification, right?
That is correct.
So you've gone way beyond duty to defend here.
Well, the Court of Appeals stopped at the duty to defend.
Well, but didn't they get rid of the whole judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
So
the court determined that there was no duty to defend in the four underlying cases, and therefore there was no reason to address indemnity since the grant of coverage is broader than indemnity. Duty to defend issue is broader than indemnity.
And if there's a duty to defend, does that mean that there'll be indemnification too?
Not necessarily.
Okay, so even if you won on duty to defend, what do we do about the indemnification?
Well, Your Honor, I think our brief establishes that there is, in fact, coverage. And the duty to defend is met as well as the duty to indemnify because this is the fact situation presented, and the facts aren't really in dispute at all in this case.
So that it's broader. Your feature is that it's a duty to defend, but your position is really much broader than duty to defend, and it was duty to indemnify also.
The claim was, but the Court of Appeals focused just on the duty to defend.
You lost the whole shebang. Do you expect this court to decide both issues?
Yes,
defend
Your Honor.
And indemnification?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the facts are not in dispute. How is it that Dorner damaged this pipe?
Sure. The underlying complaints all allege, Your Honor, that in performing its excavation and construction services in relation to the street project, its employees unknowingly didn't appreciate that a gas line was a live line and used the backhoe to push the gas line out of the way, causing it to rupture and natural gas in large concentrations to be released from the pipe.
Well, I don't mean to be frivolous, but did they call Digger's hotline?
Actually, the underlying facts did show that they called Wisconsin Gas. I don't think that's necessary. Maybe it is in some of the complaints, but that Wisconsin Gas wasn't aware that it was a live line as well.
They were unaware, did you say?
They were unaware that it was a live line as well.
Were they jury trials or court trials or summary judgment in these four cases?
The underlying cases proceeded towards settlement, and then there were motion practice with respect to the coverage. So the issues got resolved by way of settlements, and then the question was the allocation between the two insurers. Coverage under the Chartis CPL policy is straightforward. The insuring agreement of that policy provides
coverage. I'm going to interrupt you once more.
Yes.
It seems to me that, in essence, the Chartis is saying this is not natural gas, maybe a contaminant, but not under these facts. How, in a usual case, how is natural gas a contaminant? Is it that it causes asphyxiation?
It could. It can be an irritant. It's a known irritant to skin and to eyes. We referenced the MSDS sheet that shows that. Of course, it's just very well known as being dangerous and potentially harmful because of its explosive, flammable qualities.
So does that make it a contaminant because it's explosive and flammable?
It's a contaminant because it contaminates the environment and creates a circumstance in which an explosion, and here fire, could occur. The release of the natural gas into the environment causing this particular harm was a contaminant because no different than the linalool and the fabric softener and the Ace Baking case, it fouled the environment to cause the property damage and bodily injury at issue here. And all we're dealing with here is whether the pollution conditions caused the bodily injury or property damage. This is not an occurrence case. This is not an occurrence-based policy. The court doesn't have to concern itself, as in Priestler or Wilson Mutual, with what is the occurrence here. Its sole analysis really is, would a reasonable insured believe that it would have coverage under the pollution condition provisions of the charter CPL policy?
Well, it seems to me if there's agreement that it's a contaminant because it's released into the environment and therefore has danger, then there really only the issue is whether this contaminant caused the damage. Is that what the real issue in this case is?
Well, I think from Chartis' perspective, they've been arguing that the contaminated nature of the substance has to be the cause of the bodily injury and property damage. But that is not found anywhere in Chartis' policy, that type of language. Chartis attempts to graft contaminated nature language onto its definition of pollution conditions. It was in complete control of the drafting of its policy language. It could have very easily added that type of provision. After all, if you look at the Ace Baking case, any insurer who sees that decision and wants to limit here coverage, in contrast to pollution exclusion, to the toxic or contaminated nature of the substance, clearly can do so by drafting. It didn't do so. Chartis exercised its discretion when it defined pollution conditions differently than pollutant. And it's in no position now, having issued the policy and collected the premiums, to add contaminated or toxic nature language onto its policy when it didn't do so in the first instance.
Is it possible that, and that's what you're asking here, that both insurance companies are liable? I know that your liability has already been settled by you, and you're not debating that now, and you're not saying you're going to go back after Dorner and get your money back, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Acuity's, the coverage under the Acuity policy was not at issue in the underlying case. They didn't take a coverage position. They did what this court has asked insurers to do, and that is defend their insured. And that's what they did, and they made a business decision in doing so and not raising whether the pollution exclusion in its CGL policy, which is much different. It's not the mirror image of the CPL policy actually applies. And you've raised an excellent point, because I think one of the faulty premises of Chartis' argument here is that there could never be concurrent coverage.
Right. That's exactly my point. One
leaves off, the other one picks up. There's not a single case that they have cited that supports that proposition. What's more, these clauses are not mirror images of each other, because Chartis had added in this additional language of naturally present in the environment in the amounts and concentrations discovered. And in addition to that, Your Honor, the Acuity pollution exclusion has five or six different, if you want to call them limiting prongs or limiting principles, that narrowly subscribe or circumscribe when the exclusion does apply, and they're not the facts of this case. So it is our position that both insurers cover, and that's why we're not taking the position before this court that Acuity has no coverage and therefore should be reimbursed.
Would you take that kind of position? I mean, not in this case, because it may be over with in that sense, but the next case comes up after Priestler and Wilson. Are you covered? Does it require coverage if this on this case?
Under the Acuity CGL? I don't believe the Acuity CGL's pollution exclusion covers based on the facts of this case because of the circumscribed nature.
So you think that although it's a pollutant, the facts of the case make it such that it would not be excluded and you'd have to pay for coverage?
For example, Your Honor, as one example, the pollution exclusion requires that the insured have brought the contaminants onto the premises. There's another provision for whether the insured is in control of the premises or has a specific is it, you know, it's a specific job site and there's an additional insured cover. There's different enumerated provisions, none of which apply to the facts of this case. So whereas I would agree that it's a pollutant for purposes of the definition of a pollutant under the acuity CGL policy, the enumerated provisions of the exclusion, which are not at issue in this case, don't apply to the facts of this case.
Mr. Cohn, when I read the briefs, I thought that both sides argued somewhat persuasively using the Gunther decision. Does the Gunther case help you or hurt you in this matter?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the Gunther decision is applicable for several reasons. First of all, the court in that case did find that the pollution exclusion was ambiguous and construed it against the insurer. Secondly, the language of that pollution exclusion was much different than the grant of coverage under the Chartist CPL policy because the policy at issue in Gunther excluded coverage for claims, quote, arising out of the contamination or alleged contamination of any environment by pollutants. In other words, it required contamination as its damage. It was an environmental damage provision. By contrast here, the Chartist CPL policy provides coverage for bodily injury, property damage, or environmental damage arising out of conditions. So Chartist could have easily limited its coverage to only environmental damage, like the policy at issue in Gunther, caused by pollution conditions, but it didn't do so. It covers bodily injury, it covers property damage, and it doesn't require actual contamination damage per se.
Your brief says on page 38, and it distinguishes Gunther by saying Gunther explicitly, Gunther is a Court of Appeals brief opinion, explicitly based its decision on the Peace Court of Appeals decision. That's the lead paint one.
Correct.
Which had found lead paint chips were not a pollutant, but that we overturned that. Therefore, it raises, as I read your brief, raises a question as to whether Gunther is any good in light of the fact that it relied on a case that, a doctrine that we did not accept.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think in particular it was looking at the history of the CGL policy once the court found ambiguity. And I would note that Gunther was not cited by this court, neither Priestler or Wilson Mutual, perhaps out of recognition that it's no longer valid law based on the reliance upon Peace.
Yeah, but they both cited Peace.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Getting back to the question of whether the release of the natural gas here was a contaminant, this court in Wilson Mutual did come up with a two-part test, as Justice Gableman had referenced, the first prong of that test being that the substance is largely undesirable and not universally present in the context of the occurrence that the insured seeks coverage for. And the second being is a reasonable insured would consider the substance causing the harm to be a pollutant. And we meet both prongs of that test, even though, as I indicated earlier, I'm not so certain they apply here because we're talking about a grant of coverage, and we don't have the same concerns as you have with an exclusion to allow pollution to be so elastic that it doesn't provide any coverage at all. It's illusory. This court stated just recently in Wilson Mutual that when a substance is universally present and generally harmless in all but the most unusual circumstances, the court has usually found that it is not a pollutant. And further stated in contrast that if the harm is caused by a unique and largely undesirable substance that is commonly understood to be harmful, that is a pollutant, and that follows the Donaldson case, and the court went through Donaldson and Peace and lead paint in Peace being determined by the court to be widely, if not universally, understood to be dangerous whereas in contrast with Donaldson, carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide was not. And similarly, this court in Hirshhorn distinguished Donaldson on this basis as well and said that guano is not universally present and generally harmless in all but the most unusual instances.
So and I want to come back to this. The several cases that you've spent some time talking about, Ace Baking, Wilson Mutual, and now Hirshhorn, it seems to me, unlike this case, there was no intervening event. And it was the substance itself. It was the linalool in Ace Baking. It was the manure in Wilson Mutual. And it was the bat guano in Hirshhorn that was the direct cause. And I know you said this case is not about causation. And I asked you, should we be concerned about the intervening event that apparently the natural gas, I don't know if there's any indication the natural gas present would have caused harm but for the intervening event of the ignition. And why shouldn't we be concerned? It does seem to be a distinction between the cases that we've been talking about and the present case.
I really don't think that it is a distinction of merit, because in Priestler, an argument was raised that it was the nitrates that was causing the harm to well. It wasn't the manure. And, of course,
nitrates that caused the unnatural growth of the algae.
Right. And the court recognized that you can't separate out the nitrates from the manure. And after all, the manure is spread onto the fields, right, and then seeps in, and eventually there is a contamination of the wells that occurs, or similarly with the septage, I suppose. And the court said, we're not going to dice this down to the point of what is the component of the substance that is causing the harm. Just as you can say, but for the spreading of the manure, the wells would not have been contaminated. You can similarly say here, but for the release of the natural gas, the property damage and bodily injury that resulted from the explosion once released into the environment would not have occurred. It's the same analysis, and we don't have to worry about whether there was an occurrence here, because the policy is not an occurrence-based policy. All we need to be worried about is whether the bodily injury and property damage were caused by a pollution condition, and they were.
Thank you.
I was saying that this case is much different than the carbon dioxide and the accumulated carbon monoxide, and the language in the Chartist pollution policy is particularly important here with respect to the amounts of the natural gas above natural levels, and that being part of the coverage grant. Like the lead in paint, the dangerous propensities of natural gas, particularly when released into the environment, have been recognized for centuries. Like septage and like lead in paint, the handling, storage, and transport of natural gas is very highly regulated because of the recognition of the dangerous propensities of natural gas. The second issue that was addressed in the court in Priestler was, does the harm result from everyday activities gone slightly but not surprisingly awry? Chartists cannot seriously make the argument that test does not apply here. The release of natural gas is not an everyday event. It's not an event that went slightly but not unexpectedly awry.
But construction is, and your red light is on, so you'll have to tie it up, but construction is an everyday event for this construction company. And hitting a pipe or hitting something that shouldn't be hit that causes damage is an everyday occurrence.
If you follow that logic in all due respect, then farming would be the everyday activity in the Wilson Mutual case, and it wasn't. It's not the construction. It's the release of the natural gas, which is the focus. And this court said very clearly in both of the decisions, Wilson Mutual and Priestler, you have to look at the substance at the time it is causing harm, not construction activities in general, but the activity that caused the release of the natural gas, which was the negligence by the contractor in using its backhoe to push down the natural gas pipe without knowing that it was a live line that had natural gas in it. A reasonable insured in Dorner's position would not consider the release of natural gas in the amounts and concentrations that were involved here to cause a church to be destroyed and property to be damaged significantly to be an everyday activity that's gone slightly but not surprisingly awry. It was a catastrophic event that is not considered commonplace. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Mark W. Ratton, representing Chartis.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Ratton. I represent Chartis Specialty Insurance Company. I'm always glad when I get through that part of my argument because in my very first argument in 1980 out of law school, I was so nervous that I had everything down except who I represented. And I drew a blank, and the judge gave me a grandfatherly look, and he said, you're new at this, aren't you, son? So now I'm still nervous, but at least I got through that part. Let me start by just asking, giving a further answer to a few of the questions that were asked during Mr. Cohen's arguments. In terms of was there summary judgments in the trial court in the underlying case, I was involved in the underlying case. There was a slew of them. They didn't resolve everything, but that case was summary judgmented significantly. I think Justice Proster asked, how did they damage the pipe? That was extremely complicated. It was a 1973 pipe that was supposed to have been defunct with the gas shut off. It wasn't. And they did bend it or push it down, but that caused something to happen upstream, which the gas ended up in the church, which gets us to Justice Gableman's question, which was, well, what ignited it? My recollection of the expert testimony was, I don't think anybody said to reasonable certainty that they knew, but the assumption with gas experts is that when gas builds up in a confined space that has appliances and the space is vacant, which fortunately here it was, it's usually an appliance kicking on, furnace, refrigerator, whatever. And so that was the assumption, but I don't know if anybody ever opined. So I just wanted to quickly answer those
questions. It was the gas. Whatever ignited it, it was the gas that caused the ultimate damage. That is, the gas being exploded.
Right. Yes, it caused all the damage, because not because it was polluted, but because it explodes. Just like the damage in Gunther, was not because the water was contaminated with feces or whatever, but because it was wet. And so,
Counselor, if somebody had walked into the basement of that church, say they were going to use it for child care during the services, and so there was a woman down there getting everything set up and all of the gas came in, and instead of an explosion, she died because you can't breathe very well with concentrated gas. Would you still be arguing that there was an intervening cause?
I think what your question raises is what this court and other courts and other jurisdictions have held many times, which is a substance can be a contaminant in one context, but not in another. And I know Donaldson, and I think it got repeated in Hirshhorn, used the Drano example. When it spills on the supermarket floor, and by the way, that example has been used in CLE seminars on pollution coverage since the 90s. When it spills on the supermarket floor, it's not a contaminant, even though Drano's poison. However, if you have a Drano plant where it's manufactured and there's a huge release contaminating groundwater, then it's a contaminant. The reason I'm hesitant to answer your question about if somebody breathes it and dies is I think it was the Colonial Gas case out of Georgia where gas got caught up in a workman's coat, and he breathed it, but the court said, well, it was a decrease in the oxygen level that caused it, therefore it was not a contaminant in that context. So with your hypothetical and one court having passed on your hypothetical a little bit, I'm a little hesitant to say, but I will agree with you 100% that something can be a contaminant in one context and not in another. That's why, and I've known Mr. Cohen for years, and we've been in case after case together. I have tremendous respect for him. But when he stood up here earlier and said the Chartists cannot seriously argue that this was some ordinary activity, surprisingly gone awry, the answer is yes, I am arguing that. I will argue that. That's what happened here. Okay.
Counsel, let me make sure I understand the argument. Number one, are you acknowledging that this natural gas is a contaminant?
In this context, no.
Well, see, I thought you weren't fighting that it's a contaminant, but rather I thought your argument was that it is that the contaminant nature has to cause the injury. And here, the contaminant nature has not caused the injury. I thought that was your argument, so help me with that.
I'm arguing both.
Pardon me?
I'm arguing both.
Okay.
It's not a contaminant. If you look at the court's recent decisions in Wilson Mutual and in Priestler, and also not too many years before in Hirshhorn, the court defines a contaminant or pollutant as something that's impure or unclean, and then that impurity or uncleanness causes the loss that happened. The gas in this case didn't do anything impure or unclean or make anything impure or unclean.
Okay. I think this case is all about words, and those are the words in the insurance contract. And so you have in your policy an initial grant of authority that you will pay on behalf of the insured, all sums that the insured shall be legally obligated to pay for bodily injury, property damage, or environmental damage caused by pollution conditions. That's your initial grant. And so the thrust of this case, I think, focuses on how you define pollution conditions. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
In part.
Not
so. In part, because there's the second. Then there's the second issue as to whether the contaminated nature of the substance is what caused the loss.
Well,
I think Gunther is. I know Gunther got reversed by Peace, but that part of Gunther is still good law, because the court is not necessarily citing Gunther, but the court is still saying that the nature of how the loss happened affects whether the pollution exclusion applies, or in this case, whether the insurer might apply.
So your initial grant of coverage says we're going to pay if the bodily injury, property damage, or environmental damage caused by pollution conditions. So doesn't that right away take us to pollution conditions? Did pollution conditions cause property damage? Did it cause bodily injury? Did it cause environmental damage? Isn't that what this case is about? Why, what am I missing? I mean, these are your words, not mine.
I don't think you are missing anything.
Okay, so let's take a look at whether or not the bodily injury, property damage, was caused by pollution conditions. So let's take a look at your policy and see how you define it. And if this is a rather simplistic approach, but if what you have in the facts of this case falls under the definition of pollution conditions, you're liable. If it doesn't, you're not liable. Is that too simplistic?
Yes. Because
it's like just looking at the words of your policy.
Well, except that I'll go back to, let's talk about Beam with the smoke. The smoke can be a contaminant in one case and not in another.
Sure.
Okay,
right.
So there was an auto. So smoke can be a contaminant, but they said in that case, that's not what caused the accident. It was the fact that the smoke was opaque. So it was not even a pollution case.
Okay.
It's the same thing here.
So we don't look to, we have to look beyond the words of your policy. I mean, I see if it's a pollution condition that caused bodily injury or property damage or environmental damage, you're on the hook, so to speak. But you're saying, oh, it's more than that.
Well,
I have to look at something more than the words of your policy.
Well, we have to determine whether it's a pollution condition, and so you go to case law, because there's this court just came down with two cases on that subject, and Hirshhorn just a few years before.
Both cases, though, are exclusion, which you are going to define, whereas this is a coverage case. Doesn't that matter?
Nope, not in this case, because you have to look at the reasonable expectations of the insured. The insured bought two policies, one with a specific exclusion saying pollution liability, we're not covering that, you're on your own. It's a bit of an oversimplification, but that's a concept. So they bought another policy where that language was essentially moved into the insuring agreement. And by the way, those policies became available in part by encouragement from the courts and in part by encouragement from industry. And saying, all right, if you can exclude this liability, make it available on some other policy. And they did.
Your argument is that because it's covered by the general liability, that it doesn't fall under yours because it's only going to fall under one policy. Is that right?
That is what the reasonable expectation of the insured should be, because why would an insured buy a policy, buy two policies that cover the same thing?
Oh, in our post-Edgerton cases, we had a plethora of joint policies that and had to discern, you know, the coverage periods, and some of them were concurrent and some of them were consecutive. I mean, and then, of course, what do we do oftentimes? Look to the other insurance clause in the policy, right? That's what we do.
Oh, I know. Totally different issue, however.
Yes,
here you've got,
that's right.
Here you've got policies that are designed to mirror each other.
And why don't you use the same language? Or there are policies that say, and it's an umbrella policy, that will say that other policy covers up to a particular amount. We're going to cover only above that amount. But there's a reference to the other policy, and it says you've got to have this policy in effect in order to get the umbrella policy. So if you were writing a policy, if Chartis was writing a policy that took over only when the general liability policy didn't cover, it's easy to say that. We are covering you when the other one doesn't. You don't say that, though. I don't see any reference to their other coverage here. It seems to me, frankly, that it could work out that they have no coverage at all. That Acuity could have said, under Chrysler and under Wilson, they're not liable at all. They're not liable at all. And you could have said, you're not liable at all either, under the words of your policy. And they get no coverage. In fact, wasn't it in Wilson they had a policy for pollution and the liability policy, and the court held this didn't fall within the pollution policy. So you didn't get it under the general liability policy. You didn't get it under the pollution policy. You got it under an endorsement to the first, I think it was the first policy, the liability policy, and it was a $500 per incidence, which, of course, didn't cover the damage. So you could, if your argument is right, they could have no coverage, and that's what happened in Wilson.
I don't believe in this case where you have a pollution policy and a CGL policy with the language that exists in both policies. I don't think you could have a loss of this nature where neither policy would cover.
Well, suppose Acuity said it wasn't liable because it fell under the pollution exclusion. Would you still be saying you're liable, or would you say you're not liable either?
If Acuity said it was not liable under that policy,
yes,
I'd be saying, yes, you are, and I would be telling this court you should find them liable.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would be doing. And I believe that's what my client would be doing.
Sure. And so you sell a contractor's
pollution liability policy, but it's not liable here because you want the pollution to be the cause, like in Gunther, which was an exclusion case, right? The substance can be contaminated, but it has to be the cause in the essence of its contamination.
Right. And that's right in the policy, because the policy is insuring agreement says it has to be caused by pollution conditions, and which is essentially what the Gunther case held, the Beam case held, the Hirschhorn case, and the two recent decisions, Wilson Mutual and Priestler. And, you know, what the court said in Beam is smoke can be a contaminant, but that isn't what caused the accident here. What caused the accident is smoke was opaque. In Gunther, they said it didn't cause what the polluted water didn't cause the loss. The fact that water was wet caused the loss. So the pollution exclusion doesn't apply. Here, it's the explosion that caused the loss, nothing that's unclean or impure about natural gas, which is why I'm arguing both. Number one, it's not a pollutant, and number two, a pollution condition did not cause the loss here.
Well, there's a difference between a pollutant and a pollutant condition, it seems to me, or pollution and pollution condition. Now, the CGL policy of Acuity defines pollution. You've got something different. You have pollution condition. So let's see what your words say. Pollution condition means the discharge, dispersal, release, or escape. Do the facts here fit with any of those? Discharge, dispersal, release, or escape?
Depends on whether you look at it from the standpoint of it going from the pipe to the church or when the explosion occurred.
Okay, so arguably is your answer? I don't know what your answer is. So do the facts here, does the natural gas, that's what we're dealing with, I guess, it was a discharge, dispersal, release, or escape?
From the pipe, yes.
Pardon?
From the pipe, yes.
Of any solid, liquid, or gas? So it looks like this probably is a gas?
Yes.
Okay. So we've got an escape or a release or something of a gas, gaseous or thermal irritant or contaminant. So far, there is arguably coverage?
No, because it's not a contaminant or an irritant.
Okay. So it's not, this is not a contaminant or an irritant is your argument, okay? Including smoke, vapors, soot, fumes, acids, toxic chemicals, medical waste, and waste materials into and upon the land or any structure on land, the atmosphere. That would probably bode for coverage. I mean, we're talking about some kind of release into the atmosphere. Am I wrong on the facts or not?
I'm not sure a church is the atmosphere.
Okay. Is it on land? I just want, or let's see, materials upon land or any structure? Is the church a structure?
Church is a structure.
Okay. So we've got structure. Might not be atmosphere. Or any water course or body of water, including groundwater. Now you've got this. Provided that such conditions are not naturally present in the environment in the concentration or amounts discovered. Is this condition naturally present in the environment in the concentration or amounts discovered in the facts of this case?
No. I don't think that makes any difference here, though. That language, which appears throughout Acuity's briefing, they're trying to get this court to read that as an expansion of coverage. That is a limitation of coverage. They say, okay, here's what a pollution condition is, provided. Now comes the proviso. Now comes the limiting principle. That's not naturally present in the environment in the amounts and concentrations discovered. But it still has to be a contaminant, and the contaminated nature of the substance still has to cause the loss.
But, counsel, you began your argument with the Drano hypothetical. And it seems to me that the line of cases that you discussed with the Chief Justice in her most recent question to you along with the other cases that have been the subject of discussion here, Ace Baking, Wilson Mutual, Hirshhorn, that all of these cases have in common, one thing that these cases have in common is that the court has examined the context in which the substance occurred. I think about 6 months ago I read that the market for natural gas was so depressed that the producers were actually burning it off in the field rather than routing it. And in that context, no one's claiming that it's pollution. But in the context of a construction site where, because of an incident, the natural gas was placed in contact with items that have some kind of spark or flame, why wouldn't we look at the context, just like we'd look at the context with the Drano on the supermarket floor versus in the water supply? Why wouldn't we look at the context here to determine whether it's a contaminant?
I'm saying we do look at that context, and that the reasonable conclusion in that context is if natural gas just explodes and nothing else happens, it's not a contaminant and it's not a loss caused by any contaminated nature.
But there was some. That's not the case here. It did explode, and it exploded, apparently, from what you said. No one said it to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, if I remember correctly.
That's my recollection.
Okay. But at least the general testimony was that it most likely came into contact with some kind of a source of flame, whether it had been a spark, whether it had been a pilot light, or whatever they might have had in the church. Why isn't that the context that we look at to determine whether, in this instance, the natural gas was a contaminant?
Well, I think if you look at it in that context, the conclusion is that it's not a contaminant. How can it? What did it make unclean or impure or contaminated or polluted? Nothing. It's like the smoke in the Beam case. I mean, the fact that smoke can be dangerous and can be a contaminant was irrelevant to the accident. It was because smoke was opaque. It's the same thing with the Drano on the floor, and it's the same thing here. It's the problem here is gas explodes, not that it was a contaminant, given the incident that happened.
I have a problem with the definition of pollution condition. It's on your appendix 109. It says pollution conditions means the discharge dispersal of any solid, liquid, gas, or thermal irritant or contaminant. It doesn't say that the gas has to be a contaminant. It doesn't say that they're contaminants. It's a listing. And it finally winds up in a listing which says contaminant, which means other things than are named. It doesn't say the gas has to be a contaminant. It just says pollution conditions means the discharge of gaseous and I don't know whether including smoke and et cetera deals with defining irritant or contaminant. But it just says release the gas to the structure, atmosphere, or any water course, including groundwater. So where does it say that the ones that are listed are contaminants?
Well, let's talk. You pointed out it says irritant or contaminant.
That's one of the things discharged. That's one of the things discharged. It says discharge a liquid, discharge a solid or a liquid. And it says discharge an irritant or contaminant. It doesn't say that the solid or liquid or gas has to be an irritant or contaminant. It doesn't say that. Just look at the definition here on page 109. And that's to be just, let's see what it says in the exclusion.
I submit that it does.
All right.
It says the discharge, dispersal, release of, it has to be thermal irritant or contaminant. And then it gives some examples.
It says gas or thermal irritant. It doesn't say gas meaning thermal irritant.
Yeah, but if we look at the word irritant in Hirschhorn and Peace, I believe the court cited the American Heritage Dictionary, and it talks about, it defines it in terms of pathology, and it's a condition of inflammation, soreness, or irritability of a body, organ, or part.
Sure, I don't object to that.
Well, we don't have that here. For the same reason, we don't have a contaminant either.
This is what the acuity policy says. Bodily injury is arising out of, is not covered. Bodily injury arising out of actual, alleged, or threatened discharge of pollutants. Okay? What they define as pollutants. They will define pollutants as, I can never find it, covering something that is an irritant or a contaminant. But this doesn't define that in that way. It's very different language.
And I don't agree. I think the language differences are distinctions without a difference. The clear intent of these policies and other courts have so held are for one to pick coverage where up where the other doesn't. It is either or. You can have in the same event both a pollution loss and a CGL loss, but both policies can't cover the exact damage in that loss. They can't cover the exact same thing. And I could give you an example from this same construction site with these same parties. Another one of the problems on that site that spawned another lawsuit is that Dorner allegedly did something with a sewer lateral to the First Bank of Oconomowoc, I believe it was. Basement flooded. They blamed it on Dorner. Ultimately, Dorner got a summary judgment. But in the meantime, there was this pollution policy from Chartis and the CGL policy from Acuity. And we established in discovery that there was some mold contamination in the basement. That was covered. We determined the amount. That part, the trial judge held, was covered by the CPL policy, and the rest of it was damaged because water was wet, and it was covered by the Acuity CGL. All that got mooted a few months later when the trial judge issued a summary judgment for the policyholder, Dorner, that nobody appealed. But you can have different damages in the same loss that are covered by the two different policies, but you can't have what you have here, which is the two policies covering the same thing. Otherwise, the insured is buying overlapping coverage, and no reasonable insured would do that. And the discussions in the applicable case law clearly state it is one or the other. There may be an issue of fact. There isn't in this case. In some cases, there may be issues of fact as to which it is. And in some cases, like this one, the court will have to determine, okay, is this gas a contaminant or isn't it, and what's the context, et cetera. But you cannot have a situation here where the same policies cover the exact same damage.
Does your policy anywhere have a provision that discusses when other insurance applies? Because if it does, that would seem to fly in the face of your argument.
I don't know off the top of my head. I'd be surprised if it doesn't, because almost all policies have the so-called other insurance clause. But
because sometimes more than one policy can cover a loss, right?
Not in this context, but in other contexts, yes. And that comes up frequently when there's an ongoing plume of contamination that goes on several decades. But it's all the same type of policy, and it's a question of timing and a question of continuous trigger, as it's sometimes called.
So if we were to look at how other insurance applies, for example, in your policy, we would find your explanation to be set forth in that provision.
I'm not sure you mean, we didn't brief it, so I'm not sure what you mean by your explanation.
Well, that you can't have two policies apply for the same loss in this context.
You can't based on the insuring agreement. You can't have two policies covering the same loss the way Chartis' insuring agreement interfaces with Acuity's pollution exclusion.
Can you think of any circumstance in which natural gas would constitute a pollution condition?
If it poisons someone, that could be it. I can probably think of others, but in this one, I don't see it. I mean, it's just an explosion is all it is. And CGL policies have been covering gas explosions for centuries. And Acuity covered it here, as they well should have. This is a special pollution product brought out to serve a special need, not to cover everyday events that have gone awry, like a construction project where somebody thinks the pipe is dead and it isn't, and they move it, and then gas seeps somewhere, and then there's an explosion. This was a very specialized product that was not designed to cover that, because everybody knew in the industry, and insureds would know it too, a reasonable insured, that this is a specialized product covering a special thing. It doesn't overlap the coverage with the CGL policy.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Bradley, your red light's on. That's
I know.
Difficulties I have in the argument is, and this doesn't require any legal exegesis, one of the difficulties I have is your argument is the contaminating nature, and I hear that over and over again, the contaminating nature didn't cause the explosion or the injury. And the reason I say it doesn't require legal exegesis, because the argument that the contaminating nature, your argument seems to subsume that it is a contaminant, but the contaminating nature, or the nature of the contaminant, didn't cause the injury here.
I'm making both. That's all I can keep telling you. And I think.
How can you say you're making the argument that the contaminating nature didn't cause it, when that argument, by any logic, means that it is a contaminant, however, the nature of the contaminant it didn't cause it. So is it a contaminant or isn't it a contaminant? It seems to me your arguments have an inconsistent premise. What is your premise? Is it a contaminant or isn't it a contaminant?
In this context, it is not a contaminant, just as Drano is not a contaminant when it spills on the supermarket floor.
So you then don't need to talk about the nature of the contaminant.
If you came out with a decision to that effect, I would be most happy.
Okay, but that's what your argument is, isn't it? Your argument is the nature of the contaminant didn't cause it. That's what I understand your
argument. It's just an alternative argument. It's like, okay, if you think it's a contaminant, members of this court, then it's like the smoke and beam. It isn't what caused the loss here. Smoke is opaque. That's what caused the accident in Bean. Gas explodes. That's what caused the accident here. There's no pollution involved. So my red light's on. I'll sit down.
I do want to say to you that the definition of pollutant in Acuity, which is on page 6 of their appendix, is very, very similar to the definition in your policy, and you made that point. And then the question is, though, that it doesn't come in under the pollutant here, doesn't come in under gas. It comes in under the word contaminant. And that's your argument, that pollution condition here, the natural gas is not a contaminant.
That's one of my arguments.
Yes.
And it's not an irritant.
And then not an irritant, but it is a gas.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I ask?
Yes. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Rattan, you were very helpful in this, laying out some of the facts here to clarify for me. If Dorner inquired about the natural gas pipeline and was told that it wasn't being used anymore, shouldn't the utility bear some responsibility for this?
Well, they were a defendant.
Well, they were?
Yeah, and they were sovereign. You want to talk about summary judgment? There were some sovereign immunity issues. The utility was definitely a defendant. There was complicated, long deposition testimony with complicated facts about whether the gas should have been turned off in that pipe or not, since it was a defunct pipe since the 70s. A testimony about why the gas company took so long to turn the gas off. Oh, it went on and on and on. So they were a defendant, no question about it.
Let me just say, I understood this case to be whatever the fight was about the liability of Dorner or the liability of others, ultimately Dorner was found liable or settled out at being liable. And then the issue became which insurance company should pay what amount. And so that the only thing before this court is that Acuity accepted that coverage and indemnity, that is, the duty to defend and indemnity, and paid these amounts, and that you all agreed that those amounts were okay, but the issue still remained under the terms of these of your insurance policy whether you're liable. That's the only thing before our court, whether under the terms of your policy your company is liable, your client's company. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I'm not tracking. I'm very
well. What I'm trying to say to you is the only issue before the court is Chartis's liability under its policy for the damages that Dawn was found liable.
Yes and no. That determination cannot be made in a case like this where we're considering the reasonable expectations of the insured without considering the Acuity policy.
Okay. So you say you have to consider both policies.
Yes.
Clearly yours, too.
Yes,
right.
Both.
And we're not concerned with why Dawn was held liable.
I don't think so. At this juncture, they settled. There was never a finding in Dorner's case of liability.
Thank you.
Well, my red light is on, so I'll sit down. I was in the Seventh Circuit about a month ago, and they called me back, even though my red light was on. So, they have no questions.
All right. Mr. Cohn?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple additional points here. Mr. Rattan repeatedly said that the policies were designed to marry each other and that the clear intent was that one would provide coverage where the other isn't. The best expression of the policy's intent is the language of the policy itself, and he can't point to anything in his policy that supports that argument. The Acuity policy is not referenced anywhere in the Chartis CPL policy. The lack of coverage under the Acuity CPL policy is not a prerequisite to coverage. There's no exclusion if the matter is covered under a CGL claim, like there was in the URS case that Chartis relied upon. There is a workers' compensation claim exclusion, so Chartis knew how to exclude claims that would be covered under a CGL policy. In the other insurance clause that Justice Ziegler referenced in the Chartis policy, there's no reference to a CGL policy presence and applying to the claim resulting in Chartis's policy not providing liability or being excess. Rather, the only reference is to other primary policies to which it would share coverage, which we have here. And there's also a reference to other pollution liability policies, not CGL policies. So Chartis knew how to limit its liability under its other insurance clause. And I will submit to you that the reason why Chartis is arguing so vehemently that this was the intent of the policies and so forth without having a basis in its own policy is because the language of its insuring agreement harms them in this case. There's coverage here, so they have to turn to, well, that was not what this was planned to be. But this court has to rely and has to exclusively rely on what the language says. And if Chartis wanted to have a policy that said that the pollution aspects of the substance have to be there to trigger coverage, they could have put it in their policy, and they didn't do so. For all these reasons, Your Honors, we ask this court respectively to affirm the trial court and reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
On both the indemnity and the cost defense.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Attorney Cohen and Ratten for their arguments today about the duty to defend and indemnity relating to pollution. This is our third pollution case this term, and we've had several previously. They arise under different circumstances, different policies, and I don't know that this will settle pollution for all cases, but we'll settle it for this case. So ends their hearing in 2013, AP 1303, Acuity versus Chartis Specialty Insurance Company. And the students will remain, and Justice Bradley will be out very shortly and discuss the procedures with you. Counsel and everyone else are encouraged to stay if they wish. We are adjourned for oral arguments in the month of January.